Aye. I want to confess that my mother warned me about people like you. I met Jim Wilson in 1961. I was a graduate student. He was, I think, an assistant professor. But these were not the lines of separation between us. I purported to be doing political theory, and he did real down-to-earth government. There is nothing haughtier in the academy than a theorist, even a theorist with nothing under his name, confronting work on practical affairs. I was on the left, the new left, mind you, and Jim was on the center, always tilting to the right, although he confessed at lunch that in 1968 he voted for Hubert Humphrey, which I, as a McCarthy enthusiast, thought was a sin. I have moved slightly rightward, and Jim has moved further rightward. I wonder why so many introductions are really efforts at autobiography. So let me say, I have learned more about American politics from James Q. Wilson than from any single political scientist writing in the last half century. He is a practical man. He writes about bureaucracy, crime, urban politics. Are those really separate? He writes about bureaucracy, crime, urban politics, police, marriage, all of the gritty structures and environments of our society. But in the last 15 or 16 years, he has become unvarnished and unafraid and unaffected by fashion, a truly great moral philosopher. We need moral philosophy because the meaning of the so-called realists and the meaning of the so-called critical theorists is an attack on the ethical foundations of the West. The core of this is Athens, Jerusalem, Rome. In the 50s and the 60s and into the 70s, we were blessed in our universities by the usually daunting presence of a few titanic scholars who had lived through the nightmare, the nightmares, and witnessed close up the brutal realities of Nazism and of communism. There are none of those people around in universities. They had an intellectual an enormous moral presence. I think only of Harvard, Alexander Gershenkron, Adam Ulam, Conrad Block, Renato Pagioli, names that are perhaps not even recognizable to sophisticated people like us. But there is no one to replace them. No one who has seen and lived under the tyrant. And this is not a minor side point. These people were what they made was a university of refugees who knew who the enemy was and what the enemy was about, which even Lee Bollinger doesn't seem to know. Indeed, there were in the universities in the 50s and 60s and early 70s people who had been in the American Army, and they too knew what the enemy was about. And you do not have in the elite universities anymore people who have been in the American Army. So it has made for a rarefied atmosphere, an artificial environment. So I think I know why James Q. Wilson has turned to thinking and writing about Christians, Jews, and Israel. If you want to read a wonderful book which probes the Protestant strain in this, there is that book by Barbara Tuchman, a great historian never recognized by the Academy, Bible and Sword. Why, and here I've never spoken to Jim about this, so this is arrogant. Christianity, the Jews, and Israel, these are really at the core of the Western tradition under siege, now being undermined by the mainstream Christian denominations themselves. I can't read my own writing, so I'm going to jump to the end. I am really pleased to introduce my old friend, James Q. Wilson. We have little correspondences on the email. Winner of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which any recipient chosen to be so honored should be honored, whichever president gives it to him.
Thank you, Marty. Marty and I, though we tended in different political directions, talked frequently in the 1960s, including in the tragic year of 1969 when Harvard seemed determined to tear itself apart. And though our political positions have changed in some ways, we continue to talk. What's tragic to me is not that our views on some matters have differed, but that other people in this country whose views differ greatly don't talk to each other at all. The deep political and philosophical polarization that afflicts this country is, to me, one of its most profound cultural difficulties. And until we learn that the price of freedom is not choosing sides, but the price of freedom is taking sides while keeping friends, we may not go forward too strongly together. I want to talk about Christians, Jews, and Israels as an example of this problem. Christianity, Judaism, the country of Israel, all have profound commonalities. Though they differ in their religious and theological beliefs, they come in large measure from the same source. And yet today, they are deeply divided in ways that I find it difficult to understand. So my remarks today are on the following subject. Why do so many Jews and so many fundamentalist Christians agree so deeply on the importance of Israel's survival, but nonetheless dislike each other so much? And why do Jews favor African Americans, who are statistically the most anti-Semitic group in the country, and of late, but not always, no friends of Israel, when the Jews' true friends, Christian fundamentalist evangelicals, are among Israel's strongest supporters? In 2006, a Pew survey found that evangelical Christians in this country were more favorable to Israel than the average American, much more sympathetic than mainline Protestants, vastly more sympathetic than secular people. In another survey by a different group that categorized the kinds of support people gave to Israel, evangelicals were much more likely than people from other religious groups to support Israeli occupation and control of Jerusalem, to endorse Israeli settlements on the West Bank, and to believe that the United States should always take Israel's side in any Middle Eastern dispute. In fact, it is not simply with respect to Christian evangelicals that this is true. The most orthodox members of any religious denomination, Catholic, Protestant, or Jewish, are the most supportive of Israel. And the most modernist members of any religious tradition are the least supportive of Israel. What is it about orthodoxy that leads people to support this struggling country? In fact, it's remarkable that it should need support. This is a country, the only free, functioning, open society and democratic nation in the entire Middle East, that has been our ally through good times and bad, that has brought prosperity to its people while preserving their freedom. Why should we take sides on whether Israel is worth support? But we do. The National Council of Churches in the United States refused to support Israel during the Six-Day War in 1967. Immediately after Israel's victory in that war, they protested against Israel's expansion of its territory. In 2004, the Presbyterian Church decided to study a proposal to divert its own investment money away from any firm doing business in Israel. And within a year, the Episcopal Church, the United Church of Christ, and parts of the Methodist Church followed suit. The American delegation to the World Council of Churches meeting in 2006 issued to that body an apology for the villainy of America because of its imperialist efforts by means of supporting Israel to rain terror down on the world. This is a striking development, a cleavage in our religious tradition that, so far as I know, has relatively few parallels. It does have some parallels, however. If you think back to the 1920s, when I was only 40 years old, you may recall H.L. Mencken called Christian fundamentalists yokels and morons. A year after he uttered this statement, Sinclair Lewis portrayed the evangelist Elmer Gantry in his famous novel as a self-serving manipulator of gullible public, and Sinclair Lewis dedicated his book to H.L. Mencken. And with some justification. After all, in the 19th century, some evangelicals had agitated in this country for the adoption of a constitutional amendment that would proclaim as part of our founding doctrine the authority of Jesus. And in the 20th century, Father Coughlin, a notorious right-wing Catholic priest, was a leading anti-Semite whose broadcasts were heard on a daily basis by over 3 million people. Today, this hostility toward Israel and toward evangelical Christians is no longer the preserve of a few distinguished intellectuals. It is a widespread feature of the American media. The media prints scarcely any stories about the growth of liberal secularism, but scores of stories about the growth and the alleged influence of the religious right. About 16% of the American public, perhaps in reaction to these stories, hold intensely antagonistic views toward Christian fundamentalists. In a Pew survey, 42% of all Jewish respondents said they particularly felt antagonistic to evangelical Christians. But in similar surveys, evangelical Christians did not feel any hostility to Jews. So that they are united in their support of Israel, but differ in the views they have one of the other. This is such a puzzle that it seems to me somebody should look for an explanation. And I think the explanation can be found not so much in politics, but in religion. There is a doctrine that may be familiar to some of you called dispensationalism. Dispensationalism is a doctrine that began in Protestant churches in the early 19th century in England and spread across to this country. Its argument, and there are many variants of this argument, I will give you the condensed Reader's Digest version of it, is that human history is a series of seven periods in which God's relations with his people change. In each period, in each dispensation, God deals with man in a distinctive way. In the first period, before the fall of Adam, this was the era of innocence. In the second period, from Adam's time to Noah's, this was the period of conscience. In the third, from Noah to Abraham, this was the period of government. The fourth, from Abraham to Moses, was the period of patriarchy. The fifth, from Moses to Jesus, was the period of Mosaic law. The sixth, from Jesus to the present, is the period of grace. And the seventh and final period will be the millennium and the Armageddon, which will bring paradise to earth. In this view, Jews are God's chosen people. And this dispensationalist theory, all worked out by Protestant ministers, elevates Jews to a central position in it. In the words of the book of Romans, there is no difference between the Jew and the Greek, for there's one Lord for both of them. The Jews live in what the book of Romans called Israel. Jerusalem is to be its capital. And it is in Jerusalem that the temple will be rebuilt at the time of Armageddon or the millennium. These beliefs are spread among evangelical and fundamentalist Christians by a variety of religious leaders. In a study of preachers in 19 denominations in this country done by a fellow political scientist, an old friend of mine named James Guth at Furman University, he found that evangelical and fundamentalist preachers were much more likely to support Israel in their sermons than were mainline Protestant ministers and Catholic priests. And this difference persisted after he controlled for such personal factors as age, sex, well, you don't have to control for sex with Catholic priests, party identification, and the media they use. Now, Guth could not test directly whether this emphasis on the importance of Israel in these preachings directly affected their listeners, but he was able to show that self-described evangelicals who went to church regularly and heard their minister statements were much more likely to support Israel than was the case of similar people who did not attend church on a regular basis. This teaching has been magnified by the writings of others. Some of you may know the name Hal Lindsey. Some of you may know the name Tim LaHaye. Speaking in Midtown Manhattan, I will make the reasonable assumption that most of you have never heard of Hal Lindsey or Tim LaHaye. Hal Lindsey published a book in 1995 called The Late Great Planet Earth. And Tim LaHaye, with his colleague Jerry Jenkins, followed with another book called Left Behind, a novel of the Earth's last day, and then 11 more volumes on the same thing. These two authors' books, now are in print, have been sold to 100 million people. I doubt you will find them reviewed on the editorial pages of the New York Review of Books. These books, huge bestsellers not only here but in many countries, tell the dispensationalist story, discuss Armageddon, and argue passionately for the protection of Jews in Israel. Lindsay describes his book as a book about biblical prophecy, and after explaining how the traditional Old Testament prophets were often very right in what they foresaw about the future of the world, he argues, in his words, that sometime in the future there will be a 7-year period climaxed by the visible return of Jesus Christ. But this will not happen until the Jewish people reestablish their nation in the ancient homeland of Palestine. These writings and this preaching is reinforced by a number of voluntary organizations. These include Bridges for Peace, the International Christian Embassy Jerusalem, and the National Christian Leadership Conference for Israel. To be sure, these evangelical and fundamentalist groups, all oriented toward the preservation of Israel, face enemies. Their enemies are largely arraigned under the National Council of Churches. Paul Charles Merkley, who has surveyed this agitation and counter-agitation, wrote as follows, and his words are worth quoting directly. The respectable leadership of mainline Protestant churches has backed away from Israel. All of her constant friends are seated below the salt. Close quote. There are two puzzles here. Why have mainline Protestants abandoned Israel? And why do so many Jewish organizations and their voters dislike their most ardent supporters, the Christian evangelicals? The first question is very hard to answer because, as I said at the outset, Israel is a free democratic society, the only one in the Middle East, our friend in good times and bad. Trying to explain support for it seems a mysterious endeavor. I offer the following theory, for which I have weak evidence other than my firm belief that it's true. I think the problem of many Christian liberals and many seculars is that Israel is seen today as blocking the aspirations of oppressed people, and oppressed people, in their view, means the Palestinians. Now, why should they be so concerned about oppressed people? I think it is because the Marxist claims that once governed so much of the intellectual class have now largely, though not entirely, vanished. The Marxist argument was that capitalism debased, disfranchised, and oppressed the proletariat. History has shown by a series of careful experiments, you'll recall the experiments, we sawed Vietnam in half, sawed Korea in half, sawed Germany in half, put capitalism on one side and socialism on the other, and lo and behold, capitalism made in their halves the people all prosperous and free. By these elaborately controlled experiments, organized by the National Academy of Sciences and a panel of which I was the chairman, showed that Marx's focus on the problems of the proletariat was somewhat mistaken. But then, if you wish to believe in social change, who are the people you are trying to help? And the answer is, you're now trying to help the oppressed. You're trying to help people who are the victims of the world economic order or globalization. And so you have these bizarre demonstrations in Seattle and other cities of a group of people protesting against a meeting of the World Trade Organization, though I suspect not one person in the protest group could give you the faintest understanding of what the World Trade Organization is all about. These views receive warm encouragement from people such as Noam Chomsky and abroad in the European press, including Le Monde, the BBC, The Guardian, and the Evening Standard. Now, if the left in American intellectual life has moved to embrace the oppressed, and the oppressed are now identified as the Palestinians, why is it that Jews, seeing this process, do not say to themselves, well, we care deeply about Israel, and therefore we're going to look around for Israel's friends, and we're going to take them where we find them? Now, they could find them among Christian evangelicals, but there are some problems here. After all, Jewish voters and Christian fundamentalists disagree on a number of important policy questions. They disagree about abortion. I think they disagree about gay marriage. They disagree about school prayer. They disagree about educational vouchers. But these disagreements must be measured against two somewhat more important facts. One is that the future of Israel is the future of a country that has no friend save us. And were we to back away from it, Israel will cease to exist. And it should also take into account that Jewish voters are less than 2% of the country's population. Christian evangelicals are 25% of the country's population. Moreover, and I think this is the important issue, recent evidence suggests that evangelicals are not anti-Semitic. To be sure, there is the Jews for Jesus movement. It enjoyed a certain prominence. It still exists, but it has largely been a failure. I think they did not realize that Jews rarely convert, but if they do convert, it's to become Episcopalians or Unitarians, not members of the Assembly of God or the Southern Baptist Convention. Milton Himmelfarb put it once in a very famous statement, Jews earn like Episcopalians but vote like Puerto Ricans. I don't think there's any deep mystery here. Jews in whatever country they've lived have been the victims of oppression, and therefore they're quite aware of anything that might be interpreted as a sign of oppression. But though they might be right to be suspicious of what they have read by Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson, these are not really the views of Christian fundamentalists and Christian evangelicals. Pat Robertson's effort to become a Republican nominee for the presidency was a miserable failure. Jerry Falwell's organization, the Moral Majority, collapsed from want of support a few years after it was started. The enmity toward evangelicals is hard to explain given the view that most evangelicals have very positive feelings about Jews. They like Jews, and though Jews are liberals, they make a distinction in their mind. Jews are liberals, but then nobody's perfect. We can overlook their liberalism because to us, theologically, their Jewishness is the most important part of their being. And it's the most important part of their being because unless they are preserved and preserved in Palestine, Armageddon will not succeed. Now, where Jews turn for allies in current American politics are to African Americans. And African Americans have been an oppressed people, and you can understand why two groups, each the victim of oppression, would turn one to the other for support. And early black leaders were quite positive about Israel. W.E.B. Du Bois was strongly in favor of the creation of Israel over the objections of General George C. Marshall and other people who tried to persuade Harry Truman not to do it. Ralph Bunche was a supporter of Israel. Indeed, Du Bois once wrote a letter critical of Bunche because he said Bunche was insufficiently enthusiastic about creating and preserving Israel at the end of the First Arab-Israeli War. The NAACP passed a resolution endorsing the creation of Israel in 1948, and Israel has received continued support over time from Paul Robeson, Bayard Rustin, and the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. But that began to change after the 1967 war and the rise of the black nationalist and black power movement in this country. That old leadership was replaced by Stokely Carmichael, H. Rapp Brown, James Forman, Malcolm X, and curiously enough, Shirley Du Bois, widow of W.E.B. Du Bois. At a New Left convention, which I believe Marty Parrots may have attended, black delegates insisted on passing a resolution condemning the, quote, imperialist Zionist war, close quote. And of course, there is Jesse Jackson, who has said, among other strange things, that the firing of Andrew Young as U.S. ambassador to the United Nations was the result of a capitulation to Jewish interests, and later referred to this city as Haimetown. He visited Israel, but seemed strikingly unfamiliar with it, except when he spent time with Yasser Arafat, and later wrote at the end of this visit, quote, Zionism is a poisonous weed that is choking the flower of Judaism. I will make no further references to Louis Farrakhan and his statements that Jews are bloodsuckers. This dramatic change from W.B. Du Bois and Martin Luther King and Ralph Bunche and Bayard Rustin on the one hand to Jesse Jackson and Louis Farrakhan on the other, reflected, I think, the deep radicalization that black politics has undergone in this country and the rise, as I said, of a commitment to black power and black nationalism. Jewish and evangelical differences over abortion, school prayer, and gay marriage are obviously important. They should be argued out. But it is not correct to say that these differences in these discrete policy choices reflects a deep hostility between the people who are involved. Some, of course, would say I have not shown the true character of the evangelical threat to this country. They may say, and some of you may now be thinking, that evangelicals and fundamentalists are hostile to the essential elements of a liberal democratic regime. They believe the nation was founded as a Christian country. They worry about the decline of morality in the nation, and therefore they wish to impose a conservative moral code. The nice thing about social science is that we can test these things, and we've been busy trying to do so. These evangelical views about the country being founded as a Christian nation, having lost its bearings and requiring a conservative moral code, are the views of the overwhelming majority of all Americans, whatever their religious orientation. Based on polls taken in the late 1950s and reported by Professor Christian Smith, he looked at what evangelicals actually want on a practical basis. Indeed, they think America was founded as a Christian nation, so do most Americans. They believe that the country has lost its moral bearings, so do most Americans. But evangelicals also, like other Americans, oppose having the public schools teach Christian values, oppose having public school teachers lead students in vocal prayers, and oppose a constitutional amendment declaring the country to be a Christian nation. Evangelicals in these polls deny that there is one correct Christian view on most political issues, deny that Jews must answer for allegedly having killed Christ, and reject the idea that whites should be able to keep blacks out of their neighborhoods. They deny that laws protecting free speech have gone too far. On all of these matters, and excuse my horses, evangelicals think like most Americans. And therefore, the fact that there are certain policy issues that they differ with liberals about should be, given what is at stake in the Middle East, a small matter. But the left, or at least some parts of the left, does not understand this. It knows only about the religious right from the accounts written of it in the New York Times. I think that is a big mistake. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. As always, we have some time for questions. Michael Barrera, that's our only microphone. Oh, we have two. Great. Okay, so we've got good coverage. So I would ask Professor Wilson to come back to the podium and just acknowledge somebody, and then we'll have a mic get to you, and wait for the mic to get to you so that we can hear your question. All right?
Yes.
Thank you so much, Professor Wilson. You were mentioning about the development of capitalism plus success. How would you equate that with what's happening now in China, please?
Well, China has picked a role to alleviate the problems of Marxism, very different from the road that was selected by the Soviet Union. Mikhail Gorbachev thought he could reform the Soviet Union by changing its political system, perestroika, but leaving the economy untouched. China, far more wisely, said, we must emancipate the economy and allow something approximating free enterprise, but maintain political control. That, in the short run, has been a brilliantly successful strategy. In the long run, however, they will create a Chinese middle class that will demand freedom, and in time, they will get it.
two academics, Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer, have created quite a ruckus with their new book, The Israel Lobby. Want to comment on it, please?
I read the essay when it was in draft form at the JFK School at Harvard. I have not read the book. I thought the essay was shallow, imprecise, unscholarly, but perhaps if I read the whole book, I might have an even more negative view.
I think it's useful to recognize that the reason a lot of liberal Jews are wary of dispensationalist Protestants is that the dispensationalists see the end of days as a time when all the Jews will convert to Christianity. So they say, well, you see, their friendship for us really has a sting in the tail, to which Irving Kristol once remarked, well, when the end of days comes, we'll see which one is right. In the meantime, they're our friends.
Yes. I agree with Irving.
But it's also, but there's also another side to this, which is, I'm not, as you know, good at figures, but I gather that dispensationalists who hold to that view strictly are in a minority among evangelical Christians. Most evangelical Christians base their support for Israel, as I've been told by many of them, on the verse in the book of Genesis in which God says to Abraham, I will bless those, I will make of you a great nation, I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. And that seems to be the solid basis for the majority of evangelical Christians in their attitude toward Israel.
Yes. I believe that's right. I gave the history of dispensationalism and the extraordinary sales these books have enjoyed, not because I think it proves that all evangelicals or all fundamentalists believe in this doctrine of dispensationalism, least of all believe in the proposition that at the moment of truth all Jews will become Christians, but simply to suggest that there was this enormous literature that throughout is entirely supportive of Israel. And the reason for that support will vary in the eyes of the reader. Some may recall Genesis. Some may recall the book of Romans. Some may believe what Hal Lindsey says. But it's an impressive testimonial to the views of a large number of people. I would hate for all Americans to pass a test on what the Constitution or the Bill of Rights says. But the document is nonetheless important and says a lot about our country. Yes. Roger.
Jim, isn't some of the source of this friction at the heart of it that Jews are increasingly secular and that the threat of sort of friends that are much more religious is potentially very damaging to them?
You may well be right, Roger, and I fretted about this. And so I thought, I will now find data that looks at the degree of religiosity among Jews to see if that affects their views of evangelicals. And I could find no such data. I mean, when you survey a population and you're trying to extract the views of 2% of the population and then break them down between Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, or even secular, it's very difficult to do. So I can't answer your question, but that is a distinct possibility. It is certainly true of other religions. The more traditional the Catholic, the more they support Israel. The less traditional the Catholic, the less they support Israel. I suspect that's true across the board. Yes, and there's a person back here. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Goldhirsch from the Goldhirsch Foundation. I'm actually speaking as a Jew who has supported evangelical organizations and found a lot of difficulty, even among family members, to understand why I would want to work with evangelicals. And I would just want to add to what the gentleman just said, that I think that the lack of support among Jews can be chalked up to ignorance of our own scriptures. So if you're referencing Genesis, Jews often don't even know what you're referring to, or Isaiah, or if you call the West Bank Judea and Samaria, Jews don't even understand that. And I think also ignorance of the connection between Judaism and Christianity. And I guess my question to you, studying this, is there any hope, you know, in the mainstream Jewish community that this can be, this education can be undertaken, or is it something that we, you know, with Rabbinic Judaism that we've sort of left behind in our days of ancient Israel that can't be reclaimed? And I guess that's the question I think of myself, how to move forward with these alliances.
Well, I wish I could give you some advice, but you're asking in many ways the wrong person. I was raised a Catholic. I'm on extended leave of absence, but I was raised a Catholic. And I never saw a Bible. I had a catechism published in Baltimore, Maryland, which told me everything I needed to know, which was the credo and the desire to do good works. Later on, after I became a graduate student, I read the Bible to discover what I'd missing. And it turns out I was missing quite a bit. And then I read Norman Podhoretz's book on the prophets and learned that I was missing even more than I first thought. Do religions have the capacity to restore in their faith a broad understanding of their origins? I don't know. It is certainly true with evangelical and fundamentalist Christians. That's what they talk about all of the time. And therefore, in principle, it is correct. But if it's true in principle, will it be true for Jews and Catholics? Ah, that I don't know. The person, was it somebody right behind you had his hand up earlier. Yeah. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Larry. Larry Mead. The most interesting thing you've said, Jim, is how the left attacks Israel because they construe Palestinians as victims. And what's, I think, interesting about this whole debate is how the identities of victimhood and mastery get established. I found out a long time ago that if you are a white man with an English name and a PhD from Harvard, you can never be a victim under any circumstances.
We're working hard to make you a victim, Larry.
The world has decided that you're responsible for everything. I would have to go outside and be run over by a truck before that would change. Conversely, the Palestinians are victims under all circumstances. There is no way in which they can show any image of mastery. Now, the interesting thing is, and that would also be true of liberal groups in this country who espouse their cause, they too are masterful. Now, the interesting thing, and I think much of the problem of Israel, is that the Jews have a double identity. They're the only group who has been a great victim and is at the same time a great master.
Mm-hmm.
They were the victims of the Holocaust. They also show, as we all know in this country, extraordinary personal mastery and success, and they have made Israel into an extraordinary success story. Much of the resentment of the Arab world may be well be that Israel has a little of the assertiveness of a former victim. How different it would be if they were English or American or some other consistently masterful group. And therefore, they're entirely unapologetic about their achievements, whereas if we had done Israel, we would be very apologetic and we would be less hateful. So maybe the problem in this dilemma you point to has to do really with the identity of the Jews, who have this dual character.
Well, you're saying if you're successful, don't brag about it. I think Arab and Muslim hostility toward the Western world goes much deeper than this. I believe with Bernard Lewis that it reflects the sense of a lost empire. The Muslim world once controlled virtually all of the Mediterranean. Its great library in Alexandria was a place where we found the works of Aristotle. Its artists, its philosophers were important persons. But then this was all swept aside by a fundamental change in the West that they did not understand. And that fundamental change was the separation of church and state, which emancipated science, technology, mastery from religious constraints and allowed the two to coexist. Began in England in the 17th century, reached its high peak in the United States in the 18th century, and has rolled forward. And and it's the countries that are the descendants of England where it's most prominent: Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the United States, and England. The Muslim world lost, and when Sayyid Qutb was in the United States studying for a master's degree in Colorado and writing the documents that became the basis for the Muslim Brotherhood, all he could do was rage against the United States, not because we were boastful, but because our girls wore short skirts, we sometimes cussed in public, we went to dances. He thought this was a morally corrupt nation. What a bizarre conclusion. Suppose Israel had said nothing to brag about their success, except allowing women in the army to wear short skirts and to cuss on occasion. I think they would get exactly the same reaction. This gentleman down here.
Gordon Robbins. The Jewish population seems to be growing significantly in Germany, particularly Berlin. No resurgence in Poland, and yet the Jewish people are having major problems in Russia and France. Are you surprised with these developments?
No, I'm not surprised. The European Union, in a part of my lecture I left out to save time, commissioned a study of anti-Semitism in Europe. And they compiled a document that shows there is widespread anti-Semitism in much of Western and Central Europe. They then suppressed the document and did not release it. Why? Because a significant part of the anti-Semitism could be attributed to the arrival of young men and women from Muslim countries, and that was politically impossible. Happily, a Jewish organization smuggled a copy out, sort of like getting Khrushchev's speech from the 20th Congress, Soviet Congress, to find out just how bad Stalin was, and released it. But Europe faces a fundamental problem. It has anti-Semitism, and its government doesn't know what to do about it, and people may be taking matters into their own hands. Theo van Gogh stabbed on the streets of Amsterdam with a note pinned to his chest accusing him of having made an anti-Arab movie. And the note also said, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, now in this country under Dutch protection, will be next. People been throwing rocks at people in the Netherlands. The Netherlands said, this is terrible. But of course, the Netherlands government doesn't have a policy to deal with anti-Semitism because the Netherlands government is sunk into multiculturalism. Everybody is always equal, no matter what they do. I mean, if they want foot baths in schools, we'll bring them foot baths. The United States really has no line, I think, there to follow for our own guidance. Yes, at the back.
Robert James, Protestant for 82 years. Do you have a lot of confidence that that you can identify a fundamentalist or an evangelical when you see one, or talk to them?
Well, now, I personally don't have a lot of confidence. I wouldn't know what to do, except my wife's brother is one. I'm pretty sure of that because he keeps telling me. But in the public opinion polls, there's two strategies to answer this question. One is the self-description strategy. You're asked, what is your religion? And then you're asked, would you describe yourself as an evangelical, or would you describe yourself as a fundamentalist? And you tabulate their answers. The other strategy is to, instead of asking them how they describe themselves, ask them the following specific questions. Do you believe the Bible is literally true? Do you believe in Armageddon? Do you believe Jesus Christ was the sole savior of mankind? Do you believe you cannot go to heaven without accepting Christ? And so there are a variety of techniques that come up with it. You get somewhat different answers. The self-described evangelicals are a bit more numerous than those who are become evangelical or fundamentalist because of how they answer these questions. But the results are still the same. We're still talking about 1/4 of all Americans. I mean, this is not a trivial number. I'm amazed we only have one in the Wilson family.
First, regarding the distrust of secular Jews for alleged distrust of secular Jews for evangelicals. There's that same schism between secular Jews and religious Jews,
yes,
many of whom often have different visions of what Israel should be. My question is, in the last 50 years, I understand that the percentage of people belonging to mainstream Protestant denominations in this country has dropped fairly precipitously.
That's right.
And the number of evangelicals has risen.
Yes.
From a long-term political outlook, what do you think that means for our politics?
I, I don't have long-term political outlooks. I once made a prediction in print in 1960. It was disastrously wrong. I have made no subsequent predictions. As my old teacher, Edward Banfield, says, Wilson, you have enough trouble with predicting the past. I don't know what it means. It means that something important is going on in this country, and I can offer you the leading theory of what's going on, written, interestingly enough, by a former member of the executive of the National Council of Churches, who said, in his view, the drop in the enrollment in mainline Protestant churches and the growth in the enrollment in fundamentalist and evangelical churches reflected the fact that churches grow when they offer their members more, when they offer them something substantial, when they hold them to a higher standard, even if it's a standard that seems to exclude others. Whereas a church that offers you very little except a standard Unitarian sermon about the evils of George Bush and our policy in Iraq doesn't offer a lot. Now, I don't know whether that theory is true, but it's the leading theory that is out there. And if that's true, then organizations that offer their members more in exchange for the same commitment of time and effort, whether they are religious groups or voluntary associations, will get more members. One more?
Marty Peretz both comment on the very interesting issue that he raised in his introduction, which is that at one time we had, especially among our elite schools, refugee universities, and also professors who had served in the army, who had fought in wars on the American side, and who understood despotism and who the enemies are, and that we no longer do. I'd hate to see the subject drop without a few more thoughts from both of you on it.
I'll give a brief thought and then ask Barty to finish up. I believe the country would be better off if some form of more generalized national service was required. Some in the military, but failing being in the military, in other organizations which did what somebody can define as good. I remember when I was a graduate student, all my graduate student friends were soldiers, veterans. We all got our degree in 3 years. I moved to Harvard. There were no veterans. It took them 8 years to get a degree. I just think in terms of saving money for your wife, it's really a great deal to get the degree fast. What you can do about refugees, I don't know. We will continue to acquire refugees. This country, though it had the great benevolent input of primarily Jewish refugees during the Second World War, who did miracles for this country and for the world, refugee generation has not stopped, and the United States is a place where they all want to come. Marty?
I have nothing to add to what I put out. Thank you.